Tonight on Coast to Coast, True Tales and Concepts of Alien Visitors, The Extra Dimensionals. John D'Souza joins us in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. It's great to get your week underway. John D'Souza, of course, also known as the X-Man, was an FBI special agent for more than 20 years and collector of the real-life X-Files. Author has researched and uncovered paranormal experiences as they have been revealed to him. Trained as an attorney and an investigating official of the U.S. government, John has been unraveling mysteries that elude investigators, and here he is back on Coast to Coast with his latest work, The Extra Dimensionals. John, it's always a pleasure. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much, George. It's wonderful to be back on your show with the on Coast to Coast AM with you and with the greatest audience in the paranormal, basically, here.
Oh, they really are. Tell me a little bit more about your investigative government work that you did with the FBI. That alone is fascinating, John.
Well, I was a special agent in the FBI for over 20 years. When I was last on the show, I wasn't too certain about revealing that portion of my background. But since then, I had an interesting talk with the FBI, and they really weren't concerned about me talking about my FBI identity at all, so long as it had to do with the paranormal. It's kind of interesting, their perspective. But yes, I worked mostly counterterrorism for most of the time I was in the FBI. Worked a lot of the big cases, the Unabomber, the bombing of the World Trade Center in 93, 94, and all the terrorist conspiracy cases that came out of that, which were numerous in the in that district of New York. Also worked many other cases throughout the years. However, during my time in the 90s, I became fascinated with this show, The X-Files. Pretty sure you're familiar.
Oh yeah, we sure are.
Are familiar with it. So because of that, and also there was a sort of like a little mini conflagration with that show, where some higher ups in the FBI became concerned, not because of the paranormal things discussed on the X-Files, but because of how accurately they showed the FBI and government units, how their procedures are, and how their concern was, and how their goings on. Were portrayed in the show. They actually called up the creator, Chris Carter, and gave him kind of a dressing down and wanted to know what the deal was, where he was getting his information. I myself was questioned on that during that period, and I was able to say I'd never had any contact with Chris Carter but it was too late. The name, the X-Man, kind of stuck after that.
You didn't like that title, though, did you?
No, it was not a compliment. I was told that I was demoted from G-Man to X-Man. So it was definitely not a compliment. And however, Chris Carter was eventually allowed. He was told it was fine what he was doing, and the FBI didn't bother him anymore. It's a pretty common thing for retired FBI agents to be consultants on these TV shows. But FBI agents who are on board or cannot participate in that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's why they're touchy about that. So, yes, over 20 years, and it was quite something. And during that time was when I became interested in the paranormal, in the true life X-Files, so to speak.
Did you come across those kinds of cases, John, in the FBI?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, boy.
Sometimes people ask me if there's any sort of separate X-Files type division like they show in the TV show. And there's really not. But what there is there's all cases that come up as having some kind of extraordinary, out-of-this-world classification end up with the classification of undetermined and closed. That's basically where they are shepherded, where they're headed, and that's what happens with them. The most immediate one that comes to mind is the case of the Indigo children that came out of 2001 when the World Trade Center was destroyed, and all of the little children and I wrote about this in my first book, The Para-Investigators, all of the little kids across the country that had dreams and visions, and they had experiences of the collapsing of the World Trade Center before it happened. All those kids had to be interviewed by law enforcement in big cities and by FBI agents as well. And that was pretty amazing, seeing that up close. I mean, that was one of the first big experiences of the paranormal I saw during the course of real FBI investigations. And it's one that was widespread and occurred in many jurisdictions across the country, and that really left the law enforcement officers that had to deal with that, it left them pretty shaken, and that their worldview was pretty changed after that.
I bet it would be. Now, tell us, John, when you were with me a year ago, we talked about your work, The Para-Investigators. Tell me about this latest one, The Extra-Dimensionals. Tell me about that.
The Extra Dimensionals is like a collection of true life case studies and some stories heard for the first time that I have presented in this book as the revelation, really, of who alien visitors really are and why they're coming here. I use a lot of well-known case studies that people are familiar with, the classic cases, and some new cases that haven't been heard before. And I use this to build a case to uncover the real alien visitor agenda. And one of the things that I put together here is some pretty shocking conclusions, because from what I see, and I've studied ufology for a long time, from what I can see, ufology has kind of still been left in the mire of let's prove alien UFOs are true. Let's prove these are really alien visitors. And they're kind of stuck in that paradigm for a very long time. So what I always say to people is I'm here to suggest the unthinkable, that a lot of the conclusions that we've stuck to for the last 50 years in ufology have turned out to be completely wrong. And I've come to some other conclusions that may not be welcome in the comfortable circles of ufology. And some of those conclusions are pretty shocking. Extra dimensionality is like a bad penny that keeps coming back to ufology, like about every 20 years. It's been known by other names, interdimensionality. Sometimes there are authors who say ultra-terrestrials. But basically, it boils down to the hypothesis that these alien visitors may not be physical at all, and are not probably from our time and space, that they are coming here from other dimensions of reality, and they can't stay very long for some reason, and they go back to other dimensions of reality. That's one of the extraordinary conclusions that I've come to going over all these cases. And among many others that I've also come up with as well.
Jacques Vallée believes that ETs are dimensional as well, coming from different non-physical type places.
Jacques Vallée, John Keel, and many others, Philip Imbroglio, many other great thinkers have come up with this basic same hypothesis. They say one of the things that Jacques Vallée has said is that it's just strange how the UFO phenomena, alien visitor phenomena, it doesn't behave like a physical phenomena as we know physical. It appears to behave more like a spiritistic type of phenomena, which is extraordinarily strange, especially when everyone is urged to believe in what I would call alien imminency and the whole idea of alien fathers and, you know, even alien saviors, that aliens are physical. They're completely physical, like we saw in Roswell. Again, one of my shocking conclusions is that Roswell was a double trick, that it was one of these operations put together to make us believe, again, that alien visitors are completely physical like you or I. And I believe that itself was a trick, and that they just cram themselves into little metal vehicles like we would and sail across the galaxies, and then they can crash, and they can just be a couple of dead bodies in that crash, just like it would happen with humans. And one of the conclusions I've come to is that that's just not true. That wasn't true at Roswell, and it isn't true today either. That they're not just like us. They're not just cramming themselves in these little metal shells and traveling across the universe like we would, because they're not humans and they're not like us.
And are they evil?
Oh, there's a question I wasn't expecting, but, you know, that's a very touchy question, because all you have to do is look at all these cases. And without any sort of agenda, except an investigation, and that's what I do. I looked at these cases with just an investigative technique, method, and going forward as a pure investigator. And once you do that, what's funny is that you actually can see, you know, people, creatures prove themselves through their actions, and you see the indicia of evil is always imposing actions upon other creatures that are involuntary, doing things against their will. And yet, I also see cases where there's very pleasant communications, very good, positive communications. So, you know, the short answer, from what I've seen, from what I've compiled, is that there are some that are, yes, and there are some that are completely good. Because I've seen both types of cases. And I think all of us have, especially these cases that stretch back hundreds of years and even thousands of years in the stories that we hear and the stories we see recorded. We've seen both. We've seen evil actions, and we've seen very positive, reinforcing, nurturing actions. So I think both strains exist at the same time. That's how I see it.
This experience that occurred to you when you were a child, tell us about that.
Oh, well, I've had a couple. Let me tell you, the first one I had was when I was a child. I was about 8 or 9 years old, and this is what initially sparked my greatest interest in the subject. When I was about 8 or 9 years old, I was in New York City with my family. We were attending a sort of like a party celebration. I think it was a wedding, and it was late at night. And myself and a bunch of other little kids, that was probably the latest we've ever stayed up in our lives. It had to be about 1 in the morning. And we ran out into the streets, got away from the hall where they're having the party, and we ran out into the night and playing tag and different games like that. At one point, I was running in the streets. Everything was deserted. There was not even any cars out there where we were running, and we ran between two of the tallest buildings I had ever seen. It was a moonless night. I couldn't even see. It was very dark, and one of the kids, I got into a tussle. One of the other kids hit me in the stomach. I went down on the ground. One of the kids yelled out that I was really hurt. So they did what kids do. They all ran back to the hall where we had been. And I looked up between two tallest buildings I'd ever seen to that point in my life, and I saw that the stars were blotted out at this high up space in the sky, so that there were stars in all around, but this particular place where I was looking straight up were no stars at all. And I just tried to fix my vision, and I saw that this was a cloud of black, it was like a cloud of blank ink, that sort of like what a squid would throw into the water, defending itself. And as I kept looking at this blackish cloud, from the bottom of this cloud emerged an old, that just looked like a flying saucer. It looked like one of these Lost in Space type vehicles with the lights going around, spinning in a circle at the bottom, and it just emerged from there. It looked like metallic. And it came down towards me. And I was just, by this time, I was on my feet looking up at it. And a couple of teenagers appeared on my left. And these two girls were just scared out of their minds, and they were just hugging each other and yelling out. And they yelled at me, "Little boy, you better run home. The world might be ending." And then these girls disappeared. And I kept looking at this thing. I felt like a spotlight hit me from this vehicle. And it just hit me straight down. And then all of a sudden, I changed my mind, and the vehicle changed its mind too. I took a step back, and the vehicle reversed course and started going back up. And then it, like a cartoon character, it went right back into the cloud, like a cartoon character that jumps in the hole and pulls the hole in after it. It went back in the cloud, and the cloud disappeared. It was gone. So I ran as fast as I could back to my the hall where the celebration was still going on, and tried to explain it to my parents, and there was not much luck in making them believe what had just happened to me. And that was my first experience when I was a child of contact with something that the vehicle made no noise. It didn't have any of the ordinary movements, or it didn't have the texture of a vehicle that was human at all. And just instinctively, I just felt that there was something that was a supernatural vehicle, not of this earth. I just felt that.
And you were hooked ever since, weren't you?
Absolutely. That's when I started my study, my studies of what these things were, what they represented, what they could possibly be. And I've been looking into that ever since. Long before I was an FBI special agent.
What would you say to people, John, who are doubters or skeptics?
I would say, yeah, that's good. You know, it's good to have a healthy skepticism. I always do. It's very important to maintain that and to have it always. You know, the great rocket scientist Stanley Friedman. He said, he had a great quote. He said, 95% of UFO cases may very well be fraud and not real and unimportant,
yeah,
because they're just not provable. And he said, so what? What does that matter to me? Why are you telling me about that? Because all I care about
is the 5%.
The 5%, yeah, or less. That are genuinely unexplainable and very possibly supernatural. That's what I care about, and that's what I want to hear about. And I thought that was a great quote, because that's exactly how I feel also. You know, even if just 3% of the reported cases are genuinely unexplainable, what Buffon would call category 3, the ones that rise to the highest level, that's an enormous number of cases. The National Office of MUFON gets about 3,000 completed reports per month from around the world, from all over the world, every single month, at least 3,000. That's an enormous shift in what the population thinks about these cases and about their reality. It represents a huge conceptual movement. And I'll tell you, in the 60s, the number of Americans that used to believe that alien visitors had contacted or were contacting the Earth was about 30%, 33% in rolling average polls. Today, that number is, according to the National Office of MUFON, is about 77% of Americans believe that alien visitors are contacting or have contacted the Earth. That's a huge conception.
Oh, it's massive. Stay with us, John. We're going to get more into your work, the extraterrestrial dimensions, and get your take on just why this is happening. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. John D'Souza with us. We're talking about his latest work, The Extra Dimensionals. His website, of course, is linked at coasttocoastam.com. John, in your investigations, of course, you've looked at stories that some of us are very familiar with, but I wanted to talk to you about them and get your take on them. The first would be Martha X Outreacher. Tell me about that one.
Martha X Outreacher is, an outreacher is the people who get together with an instructor and make attempts to, through meditation, visioneering, and various techniques, attempt to reach alien visitors and to communicate with them and get with them and understand them. And, you know, there's a lot of people, they try to do it with adequate precautions when they can, what you would call white light protection as well, because you got to be careful with this sort of thing. And so outreachers, they put themselves into communication. Sometimes they're successful, other times they're not. Martha X was a young lady who got involved with a guru of one of these groups, and with the group, she was at one point, they were all on a regular schedule of doing outreach to alien visitors. At one point, she went to, she was in continuous communication. She went to her bedroom. She followed instructions that she received from a voice, which was disembodied entity that was communicating with her telepathically. She removed all of her clothing and sat on a bed and waited for the communication. She was transported at one point to a facility of some kind. She was laying on a table that seemed metallic, but the metal was very yielding and appeared to be alive and somehow affected by her body, where it would become soft wherever she touched it with her body. Then she experienced some probing experiences with these entities. They communicated to her to remain calm. At one point, she felt like there were things being done to her body that she did not agree with. But at one point, they put some sort of liquid on her to calm her down, make her more malleable, more receptive, and she finished going through the experience. Now, shortly after that experience happened, she was turned over to some kind of human authorities who she says then implanted some sorts of devices inside of her. And what she considered a positive experience turned into something highly negative. She says her memories went into some kind of human military types that took her and continued experimenting on her, and the majority of the experience was to implant devices inside of her. And she has labored, and basically the group would not give her any help after that experience. She tried to speak with them, and the group, the guru of the group basically told her that if she experienced anything negative, it was because she was herself negative, and that the human military authorities that she was handed over to probably didn't exist, and they were probably just a screen memory of something, that the implants don't exist that she had also. Now, this was a woman that when I was interviewing her, and this many years later, of course, when I was interviewing her, she had to stop conversations because she said they're buzzing a signal into my brain. And she would grit her teeth. I could see the hairs on her arms standing up, and her neck would scrunch up, and she would say, this is them doing this to me. And what was your question?
No, I was going to say, did you believe that?
Did I believe her experience?
Yeah.
I absolutely believed her experience, but I didn't believe the part about her being handed over to military authorities, because that is so often, in all these cases that we look at, that's so often used as a screen memory to cover the activity, and sometimes to erase the memory of the alien visitors and what they did. So that part, it sounded to me like a screen memory. But the implants were real, because I saw physically the effects on her when she was trying to tell me her stories, because she had many stories of government interference with her after the fact. And she said, those people are surveilling me, they're following me around, and they're part of the government because those are the guys I was handed over to. And she believes that it was without knowledge of the alien visitors. And so what she said was mostly a positive experience turned into a nightmare that has plagued her ever since. But any suggestions that I would give her or other people would give her of maybe having the implants removed, we all know about the great Roger Lear and the work that he's done, she would not want to hear, she would get fuzzy on removing her implants or trying to get rid of them. And if people would suggest to her that the alien visitors may have been the ones that implanted her with devices, again, she rejects that. So it was a very strange case, but in a lot of ways, it was very reminiscent of the patterns that a lot of abductees follow. They tend to, a lot of them, or at least a good portion of them, learn to love their implants. And, you know, they complain about them sometimes. But when you suggest a way for them to get those implants removed, they get fuzzy. They get fuzzy on why they can't have them removed or aren't willing to or don't want to. So Martha X was a mixed bag, but a very fascinating case of the things that she went through and the things that she was willing to accept and the things that she just would not contemplate as far as remedies for her situation.
You looked at the very strange Battle of Los Angeles case of the 1940s.
Yeah, the Battle of Los Angeles was a case that many people kind of vaguely recall. It was during World War II when all of California was on high alert for Japanese invasion
yes.
of the coast.
And the Japanese were sending bomb balloons over too, weren't they?
I'm sure they were.
They were flying them over, floating them over, actually.
Yeah, they were probably doing a lot more than that too. But the Japanese Zeros did not ultimately appear. And what did appear were several plasmic sort of UFOs that appeared suddenly in Los Angeles. And what happened, strangely enough, was all kinds of anti-aircraft batteries set up, and they all cut loose at the same time at this looked like a pair of UFOs that were just standing up there. And there's plenty of old newspaper accounts of this, and anyone can look them up. And they were just standing there and receiving fire, but the fire passed through these plasmic vehicles, these plasmic UFOs, went right through them and right back down to the ground. And one of the things that isn't often published is that several civilians on the ground were killed by these shells that harmlessly passed through these UFOs and went right back on the ground and killed several of the civilians. And a couple of the shells did crash into each other, because we're talking an enormous number. They lit up the sky that night with these shells, with anti-aircraft batteries. And some of the shells did hit each other. So on the ground, they didn't know if mission had been accomplished until much later, days later, when for examination of the pictures showed the UFOs very happily just floating away after all these shells had been thrown up for several minutes in a barrage that had not been seen in California, I'm sure, ever since. So it was an amazing night, but it goes to the plasmic nature that I believe most of these paranormal UFOs have. They have it, and we see this nature again in Rendlesham Forest, when there was an invasion of the Rendlesham Forest military base that was an American military base on British soil. And there was just this invasion of several plasmic vehicles, some of which were just bumping along in the night, acting like wounded animals, sort of leaking light and just smashing into trees and trying to make their way through the forest, followed by several terrified troops who were trying to establish what these things were and what they were doing. So, yeah, that's one of the incidents. Oh, but what I want to mention about all these cases, George is something, if I could channel Linda Moulton Howe for a moment, I want to give people news they can use. The FBI, after 2001, and many Western nations, as a matter of fact, dumped out all of their unclassified, because of age, unclassified 40 years or older.
They just cleaned out the files, didn't they?
Yes. They dumped them out on the internet, and it's at vault.fbi.gov, and these documents are all there, and all paranormal subjects are in there. All these cases, we're talking hundreds of thousands of documents, and they're all dumped out there. All of the Kennedy assassination, there's cattle mutilations, there's UFOs. I mean, it's an enormous, enormous number of documents in response to the classic FOIA requests, Freedom of Information requests. So if somebody put in a FOIA for the word UFOs, give us, we want to see everything on UFOs. Basically, this has the response in it, these files. So a person just has to go to vault.fbi.gov. Then they have to click on the right where it says unexplained phenomena. And then under that, they just click on UFO. And then there is one document in there I call the smoking gun. It is the single most, because they've got in there documents about Jimmy Hoffa, they've got documents about JFK and the assassination, but the single most downloaded document is this document I call the smoking gun document. And it is, once you click on UFO, it's on the left side under UFO Part 1, and it is page 22. It's called A Memorandum of Importance, and it is, has been downloaded in the millions, even though it's not easy to find, but it is the single most downloaded document basically in American, in the history of American government archives. It is a one-page summary, basically, from a special agent of the FBI who decided that he had to advise the scientific community and some officials, whatever that means, some officials, but all this stuff went to Hoover, though. Hoover had to see all these communications. So he was, it appears he's probably some guy with scientific, an agent with a scientific degree himself because of the way he uses language. And he put down several conclusions, about seven conclusions of things that he was told. And he says in the first part of this communication, and this communication is in my book, The Extra Dimensionals. I actually put the communication there, and I also examine it line by line. He put in there that he has a secret informant. He has a source, what we would usually call a human asset, or a technical asset. But he says his informant is supernormal, which is an old-fashioned word for paranormal or supernatural. He says that because of who his informant is, it's likely that the scientific community will not accept the things that he is being told. And then he says, but I still have to tell just because it's the truth, so I have to try. And then he lays out about seven conclusions of things that he was told by this informant, who to me appears like he's intimating that his informant is himself an alien visitor. At least that's what it looks like. You know, in the FBI, you can't reveal the identity of an informant, but he can reveal the species, and it appears that's what he does here. And then he says, basically, their mission is peaceful. They are here to contemplate a permanent residence in our plane of existence. Now, why does he say that? The reason he says that is because he says these alien visitors are not physical. They are not incarnate. They're not like us. He says they are from another dimension of reality, another dimension of time and space. They are not from our physical universe. And he says they transit here by changing their vibration to our vibration of existence. And they also disappear the same way. And then he says, the flying saucers that we see, there's nobody in there. Those things are empty. He says they function on a sort of remote control that is beyond our technology. Then he says, basically, these people are, the abilities of these flying saucers, these discs, are so sophisticated and beyond ours that if we send our jets to attack them, it would be a tragic mistake.
Oh, my God. And we've tried that before, too.
Oh, yeah. And he turned out to be right. But the most important thing he said is that these beings, these things, they are not physical like we are. They come from different lokas, which is a Vedic term meaning dimensions, that are completely separate from where we are. It's like the astral plane, but completely different from the astral plane. And he says, we need to understand that these things are so different from us that it's hard for us to imagine where it is they come from and where they are returning to. So this communication is largely where I got basically the name for my book, Extra Dimensionals, because this communication reveals the most intimate nature of alien visitors and why they're coming here. And I would urge anyone to go take a look at these. Go take a look at this document.
Are they taking people, John? Physically taking them?
They are, but physically may not be the right word in complete sense. We see so many of these abductions that occur, but they could be occurring through translation of the individuals into a different sort of etheric plane. Because basically what we see with the abductions is that there are so many steps that were established to these human alien visitor abductions. And as you examine more and more of these alien abductions, especially the first one that really set the pattern for alien for human abductions by alien visitors, which was Betty and Barney Hill.
Oh, which was a great case, wasn't it?
Absolutely, it was. And especially once they removed, using hypnosis, once they removed the screen memories from Betty and Barney Hill. And that's when the story really begins, really, because Betty and Barney Hill, of course, they were driving home from vacation. They were stalked by, well, their car was stalked by a plasmic vehicle that was chasing their car. And then, of course, they lost time. They had that weird pinkish powder all over Betty, and the man was Barney, had certain items torn, and eventually, under hypnosis, they were able to get to the real memories, and those memories were pretty negative experience. But what this abduction did was it really set down the steps.
Yeah, it sure did. We're going to talk more about this. The Extra Dimensionals will take your questions next on Coast to Coast AM.